Welcome to Maintainable, the podcast where we explore the art and sometimes the mess of software that lasts. We speak with seasoned practitioners who have helped navigate technical debt, untangled legacy code, and helped teams build sustainable and resilient systems. Because good software isn't just about shipping fast, it's about making it last. I'm your host, Robbie Russell. On this episode, I talk with Sarah Jackson. She's a senior developer at Thoughtbot. We talk about how documentation can act as a living part of our systems, what it means for a team to feel confident in the long-term success of a project, and why Sarah sees ports as a practical alternative to full rewrites. She also shares why she prefers to keep tests wet, not overly dry. And we dig into the value of chaos engineering on the application layer and how it could be one of the ways that we unlock future investments from stakeholders. Sarah joins me from Massachusetts. Sarah Jackson, we're so glad to have you join us on Maintainable. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Glad we can make this happen. And a quick shout out to Murray for recommending you to come on the podcast. So this is for you, Murray. It's a special edition just for you.
I felt honored to be recognized.
Do you know Murray very well?
I actually don't.
Oh, okay. Oh, awesome. Hopefully you get a chance to get to meet him or talk with him at some point. All right. So given your experience in the industry, Sarah, what do you believe are a few common characteristics of, dare I say, well-maintained software?
One of the big things for me is documentation. Anyone that has heard me speak ever has known that documentation is king for me, or queen. If I come into a project and I see that there is good living documentation and good practices amongst the team, so they're making good use of wikis or repo markdown files, if they have a really good ticket history, they have a ticket process, or they have extensive use of commenting, however they like to document things, and that there is a trust that the team has in the documentation that they've created, that they continuously update it and don't bemoan the sort of process of constantly updating documentation. That's a huge green flag for me, that the product, the software, whatever it is being well maintained and love is being given to it consistently.
You know, documentation is an interesting one where we both work in the consulting space and we come into existing software projects probably quite a bit. Maybe you actually work more maybe on greenfield projects than where I do at my company, but you're shaking your head no. But the thing I'm always curious about is I feel like when I talk with teams about how they're approaching their documentation, it's always well, at some point we're going to revisit this and we're going to put it into a better one source of truth location, and we'll get it at some point. And so I feel like most people are very hypercritical of their existing documentation more than it being oh, actually, we were really good at this. Have you had a lot of experience where you come into scenarios where you're wow, this team really has figured this out really well?
Truly, it's fairly rare, to be honest, that a team is not hypercritical of their own documentation. Even if it's good documentation, I think we're all our own biggest critics. But there are teams that, even if they're hypercritical, they're still doing it, and they're still not letting perfect be the enemy of good, and making sure at least we write this down somewhere.
Do you find that those teams that you've seen it done well, that they have that baked into their pull request process? Is there checklist items somewhere that's asking them to do something? Or is it more of they just seem to know that when they're making changes over here, they should probably update the documentation over in this other area, or that it's all part of the same package of unit or work or whatever that someone's working on? Is it a process thing, or do you feel like there's something kind of seems intuitive to that group of people?
I think it actually depends. I've definitely seen both cases. A larger teams, it's very useful to have a checklist, to have a PR template that includes a checklist of things that you should do and update. I've seen that work really well. In smaller teams, I've also seen just the culture be around, okay, let's write this down. Even if it's not necessarily updating old documentation immediately, let's write down the new thing and make sure that it's visible. So it depends on the team and the dynamic, but I've seen both work really well.
Do you feel like those teams are also really good where documentation has looked good, that they're really consistent about removing outdated documentation?
There are times where there will be outdated documentation, but I think those teams that do it best are the ones that when they're looking at the documentation, they go in and make an edit. It doesn't have to be a big whole thing. Oh, I'm going to write a whole page. It's just, oh, I noticed that this is out of date. I made an edit right now. Maybe they don't even tell anyone because it's just so part of the process. Or raising it in a retro. Oh, I was going through the documentation. I noticed this. Should we revisit it? Are some of the things I've seen. I've also seen people leave comments in the documentation to be like, this is outdated. I'm not sure what the current process is. I personally prefer the tactic of whoever sees it, updates it. So whoever is going to the documentation and notices it's wrong and out of date, then update it. Obviously, if you know the documentation exists and you're changing something, you should update it as well. But I feel like the obligation is on the new person who has noticed that it has caused them harm in some way by being wrong to update it.
Do you think that there's anything related to, I'm just thinking around, what are the little carrot sticks or the incentives for updating things, where let's just assume people listening are working on a team and, you know, they're, however their team organizes their work and they're getting assigned work or they're picking items out of their Jira boards, linear, wherever their teams are working at, and they're working on something, and then they have to go look up something that's maybe related, and they discover something, and then they have that moment of being like, is this outside of the scope of what I'm needed to be prioritizing? So I might need to come back to this. And so maybe that's where the commenting approach works. But also, while I'm here, maybe it would take me 5 minutes to improve this or delete something that's outdated or no longer relevant. Like, we don't need to have that extra note about, like, if you're running on a pre M1 laptop, maybe we don't need this. Maybe we've all updated our laptops at this point. We don't need to do that anymore. What do you think it is that keeps people from just taking those extra steps? And do you think there's any aspect of, like, well, they're not, and if they don't do it, or if they do it and they don't even get maybe recognized for doing it because they didn't tell anybody, then it's kind of like this invisible. I'm always extra curious. I'm like, how often is documentation getting updated where just like the rest of the team doesn't even know about it? And so they just assume nobody's doing it. Nobody else is doing it, but actually maybe people are doing it. I feel like it's an interesting kind of like challenge for teams to, like, how do we build momentum to do that, make it regular without it making it seem like this big thing?
100%. I actually have a talk proposal written about this kind of topic, about incentives around this kind of work and how it is kind of invisible work. So for it to work well, I feel like there needs to be a top-down incentive coming, or like messaging from management, leadership, even just within the small team, that this is valuable, that not doing it hurts us. More often than not, a team will say, it's not worth it. It's not worth the time. It always gets out of date so quickly. But I think it's a mistake. I think that it's in the same way that saying tests aren't worth it, tests take too much time, is a mistake. Because the benefits to having documentation that's consistently updated are that new people have their questions answered for them without necessarily having to reach out to someone for the answer. Or if they reach out to someone, they can easily give them a link. If you need clarification on, oh, why did we make this decision? Oh, look, we have decision documents. And I like Confluence has there's a feature that Confluence has where it will regularly email you a digest of updates, if you like, to different pages that your team uses so that you can see, oh, what is going on, what is changing, and be aware that that work is happening. In order for it to be something that a team does, it definitely needs to, for product team especially, you need to feel safe doing that work. You need to feel like you're not going to have negative repercussions for taking some time just to document things. That's like, it's not hurting your velocity, that sort of thing. It honestly will make the whole team go faster in the end, because then you'll have all those questions sort of answered, laid out there. Another part of documentation that makes it better for the team, not just writing it down, but making it visible, making it accessible, pinning it, bookmarking it in your Slack, linking pages together. If you are using multiple tools for your documentation, linking those together.
You know, I think about a lot of software projects to start off with a very small team. It's safe to assume that you work kind of in the Ruby on Rails space as well. So like, you know, it touts itself as a one-person framework, and eventually teams emerge out of that. You might have small teams, what have you, early on. And so like, you don't even know necessarily early on in the process if your product is going to find an audience, a customer base. And so you don't know if it's going to have be alive in 3 to 5 years from now, right? So there's this interesting kind of tension, like, where do we invest time now while we're kind of figuring this thing out versus like, we may need this down the road. And there's kind of like, people talk about like performance issues as well, like on just a coding level, like, well, let's not worry about all the performance issues that we might have one day because we don't have those issues yet. So we don't have the documentation pain points yet, because just a few of us kind of understand how things are. We're carrying it in our head. So where do you feel like there's that point where teams really need to start taking that a little bit more seriously? Or do you feel like that should be day one? Like, hey, let's just assume we're going to succeed and we're going to have these problems one day. Like, where's that balance there for you?
For me personally, and this is a hot take, day one, be confident, trust yourself, and also give yourself the peace of mind that it doesn't live in your head. You know, there's this concept of closing the loop. You have a thought, you write it down, you set a time in the future to like address whatever it was that popped up in your head. Then it's no longer living in there, repeating in there. The apps that are even small, developed with 1-2 people, it still becomes way too much context for one human to hold in their head at one time. Very quickly. I think people really underestimate that idea. And I mean, I don't know what I had for lunch last Wednesday. Are we all sure that we're going to be able to trust why we used one tool over another in our implementation of our new tool? Like, probably the 1 or 2 people, you know, did the research, had a discussion about the pros and cons. If you didn't document that anywhere of like which linter to use, and it doesn't need to be a big in-depth thing. It could just be, we chose this one for this reason. We didn't choose this one for this reason. You don't have to keep that in your head. We're making so many decisions on how we're going to design and develop our software every single day. Not every single decision needs to be written down, but these big things that you know you're going to want to come back to, you know, when someone joins the project, because your project will be successful, be confident, they're going to ask those questions too. They're going to want to know. You're not going to remember in a year, very likely. So write it down now.
Hey, listeners, it's Robbie here. You know, it wasn't all that long ago. I'd find myself debugging a weird issue in one of our clients' Rails app. I log into one platform to track down the error, only to realize it was tied to some performance issue. And guess what? That meant hopping over into a completely different tool and trying to match things up based off of timestamps, if I was lucky. And let me tell you, my productivity didn't exactly thank me for that. Enter AppSignal, our podcast sponsor, and the tool that eliminates all that back and forth. They bring error tracking, performance monitoring, host metrics, custom metrics, uptime monitoring, and logging into one seamless platform. It's a single source of truth that helps keep your app running like a well-rehearsed symphony. Whether you're working with Ruby, Elixir, Node, Python, or tracking front-end errors in JavaScript, AppSignal has your back. They're always adding support for more languages and frameworks too. And here's the best part. AppSignal won't break the bank. Plans start at just $23 US a month. Plus, they're ISO 27001 certified and fully GDPR and HIPAA compliant, so your data is safe. Oh, and because you're a loyal Maintainable listener, you can use the promo code Maintainable at checkout for 10% off your first year. So head over to appsignal.com. Tell them that your good friend Robbie from Maintainable sent you, and start making your app sing. I think that's very wise. And it's interesting thinking about one. I think to appreciate the believe in yourself and believe in the projects that you're working on. And if you don't believe in it and assume it's going to, like, what are you doing? Getting a paycheck or something? Hopefully not. So setting that aside, thinking a little bit around like just getting it out of your head is like a super valuable thing. And then it's interesting. We have these scenarios where we get clients that'll come to us. There's one like within the last week or so. It's always the same thing, a very similar thing, where it'll be like one, maybe two developers worked on a project and it was like freelance for several years or something. And the client's like, we love this developer. They've done such great things for us over the last 5 years, but that developer has now got a full-time job and they're no longer able to provide ongoing support for their project. Comes to us and then the developer is kind of like behind the scenes being like, I'm so sorry. I did not spend time writing a bunch of documentation. We didn't use any sort of ticketing system. There's a lot of emails. The README file just says to do at README. You know, it's like, because they're the only one pretty much has ever touched that project. Yet it's in production. It's very important to this business that uses it. And they don't have a need to have full-time engineers working on this project. They just need someone to occasionally make changes to it. And now like there's this huge like, oh, now as the consultants coming in, they're like, well, we're going to be this expensive getting up to speed thing. And then so having to have conversations with the client that owns the piece of software to be like, well, let's think about it this way. You've saved a lot of money over the years because you weren't paying them to do these things. It didn't mean that they shouldn't have been done, but just they didn't do that. And so that was a lot of extra stuff that would have been helpful to pass it on to someone else at some point. And now you're going to have to pay for that. And that's an awkward situation for anyway, that's one of the fun parts of being in the consulting business is having to figure out how to navigate those awkward sales conversations where they're like, our developer was amazing. And you're like, yeah, but they also kind of kept everything in their head. And now this is going to be a fun process and it's going to be a little bumpy for a little bit while we get our head wrapped around it. But anyways, so documentation, it's a good thing. You believe in it and you think it should start from day one. All right, got that. Got you on the record about that. So one of the things that I was really inclined to want to really talk with you about is that you gave a talk, I think it was last year at RubyConf, about chaos engineering in particular. And I've heard about this before and I admittedly haven't dug into it. So I'm going to come at it from a curious perspective. I watched your talk and came up with some ideas and things we thought we could talk about. And I will share a link for everybody in the show notes for they can go watch the talk as well. But specifically, you talked about how you can apply it at the application layer. So before we talk about that, maybe just kind of, can you give us like our audience, like an idea of what, for those that are like, what does chaos engineering mean? Quick definition of that. And then maybe we can drill into that.
Chaos engineering is typically a process that exists within the DevOps world, system reliability engineering world, which is why a lot of people that are in the Ruby on Rails developer world might not know what it is, which is perfectly fine because it's very uncommon to use it at the application layer, but that's changing. So chaos engineering is the idea of forcing errors, causing issues on live production instances, applications, etc., examining the results and hardening the infrastructure or the application accordingly afterwards. Chaos is a bit of a misnomer. They're very planned, organized experiments. There are very specific inputs, specific errors that are going to be thrown or caused, issues that will be caused, for example, turning off a server or set of servers or turning off a database. And it is usually done for a specific amount of time with a rollback plan so that, A, once the test is done, you can roll back to healthy state quickly, but also if you start noticing too much customer impact, then you can also roll back quickly is the general flow of work there.
In that scenario, do you know if teams are doing that? Does everybody know that that's happening? Or is it even maybe, I'm air quoting, chaotic to do it when your team, maybe a subset of your team knows you're doing it and then the rest of the team doesn't know about it? So you're not just testing the software, but you're testing the response of the organization?
I think every organization does it a little bit differently. Netflix is famous for popularizing this concept within the DevOps world. They really developed some of the first tools that were really known. I think they may have coined the chaos engineering moniker, but I'm not exactly sure on that. Obviously, it has been a practice that has been going on longer than that. But yeah, different organizations will handle it differently. I think most organizations do announce it. They call them fire drills. They say when, they say where, so that the team that is maybe not on DevOps specifically knows what's going on. Maybe like customer service will be able to answer questions if they get calls, things like that. The team that is running the experiment will be actively taking metrics, recordings, notes about what is going on. I do know that there are some organizations, I don't know the names off the top of my head of which ones do which, but I have heard of this, of unannounced fire drills to do exactly what you said, see the response of the actual team. This is really good for, you know, testing your sort of like DORA metrics, like response time, how quickly you can get things back up, how quickly your customers are not affected anymore.
Seems like a good risk assessment process, not unlike kind of like security tests and, you know, maybe hiring outside team or having your own internal people internally try to stress your security infrastructure for your software or your organization as a whole. So I think that's helpful for us, like on a high level. So I'm curious about your take on more on like an application layer. What do you mean by that? Is that writing code specifically to handle certain things, or is it just like intentionally injecting bugs? Or like, talk me through that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. When a fault is injected in a traditional DevOps infrastructure chaos engineering experiment, regardless of what it is, it will cause application errors of some kind. So you can almost cut out the middleman to some degree. There's so much value in the reality of what's happening with those things, servers actually shutting down. But you can take those sorts of errors that would happen, like you're getting a 404 from your server, or you're not able to authenticate somewhere. You can take those errors, you can inject them at the application layer. There are tools to do that separate from like your own app code that you would run, and they would be able to hook into certain calls or routes, or, for example, and say, oh, this is whatever error code, whatever non-success code. And you can see what happens with the application. You can see the logging of your errors. You can see like, what does the page look like? How long does it take to load? What are the measurable customer impacts? Where do we need to shore up the application so that what the customers deal with is not as significantly degraded? I think chaos engineering on the infrastructure side is to make sure that service itself is not degraded. On the application side, it's when service is degraded, how do we handle it as gracefully as possible?
That's interesting. So maybe for our audience, can you think of an example? So let's say that you have like a web application and users can log into an app and then pulling some data from your local, you know, from your database. Maybe it's a Rails app and it's using pulling stuff from Active Record, but also maybe it's pulling data from a third-party API and the API is not responding at the moment. What sort of ways might this apply to that type of scenario?
Yeah, absolutely. If a third-party application is not responding correctly, what does your page look like? Being able to run this experiment in a controlled way, in a way where maybe you haven't faced this issue yet, but you don't know what your application's going to do. We can all trust ourselves and love our code and do the best that we can. But at the end of the day, do we really have trust that if this worst case scenario happened, the third party service is down, whatever, that do we know how our application will respond? Will it crash? Will it just be a blank page? Will we get a stack trace dump on viewable by the user? Things like that are what we would want to test for, what we would want to see. We could see where the weak points in the application are based on the response of we inject this fault. Our application's calling out to the third-party API. We intercept that call, send back a failure, and see what happens. Obviously, observability, I mentioned this in my talk, you have to have a lot of observability baked into your application beforehand to make this worthwhile so that you can actually analyze the results.
You know, and I think that it feels like that also then becomes like a thing for whoever's responsible for like the UX, right? Of the, like, how do you, if that's particular scenario where you're fetching data from your database, that's coming back, but also you're having to fetch some data and that's maybe happening in your Rails code, or maybe it's actually being pulled from JavaScript, is trying to make a call out and pull some data in to build out a widget or something, and then that's not responding. How is your page going to gracefully handle that situation? Or what would you like them to happen? Or how do you notify the user of like, hey, some data is here, some of it's not, like this particular module's unavailable at the moment, like versus it just being like a, you know, a little error message in your JavaScript console or something, and people are like, it's not working. It seems like a worthwhile thing to invest some time around, because that would impact your customer's experience and their confidence in your platform. You mentioned that observability is so foundational. It's like you need to have that kind of in place already. How would you describe what enough observability looks like for teams considering experimenting with this?
the whole app doesn't necessarily need like full coverage or anything. I would say focus on when starting putting place in observability, if you don't have any yet, look for a very small, limited scope sort of area of your application that you have a lot of confidence in that maybe doesn't have a lot of moving parts, you know, no third-party interactions. As a starting point, put observability in there just around those pieces, sort of like I've received this call or this is the response, you know, things like that. And they don't need to be turned on at all times. They could be things that are used just during the experiments, because logging can get large, logging can get expensive. But knowing what you want to measure and what you are looking for, what hoping for, you start with the hypothesis of, you know, if I get an error from my database, I expect that my page is going to hang. Write some observability in according to that. That you would be checking for those sorts of things or recording metrics on like page load times, things like that.
For those also listening that may be thinking like, what, where's that observability come into play there? And like, is it more than just installing New Relic, the gem for that, or AppSignal, or whatever platform you might be using or not using yet, if you might be considering, like, is it just be able to track what every request cycle is happening? Is that kind of fall under observability versus just APM type data that you're collecting? Is there something different there that for those that might not know what the distinction is?
I think for each team, it's important to determine the metrics that are important to the team. So I know that there are teams that really highly value performance and page load times. So I would measure that. Not every team is going to care about that. Not every team is going to measure that. I think a lot of teams don't anymore, considering how fast some of the things like React and everything has gotten over the years. Requests would be a big one. Responses to those, and that they were sent out, and how long the response back was. Interaction times could be another good thing to measure. It depends on what you are worried about the customer dealing with the most. But definitely, I would say, depending on that, it could easily go beyond the general observability metrics that any application would have just by default.
We'll be back with our interview with Sarah in just a moment. Hi, it's me, Robbie. I just want to take a quick moment to say thank you for making time to listen to Maintainable. If you're finding these conversations valuable, you know what to do. You know what to do. Head on over to Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Please give a review. And or maybe shoot me an email and say, Robbie, I really enjoyed that episode you had with Sarah Jackson. Or if you're looking for something to write on a review, to be like, I really enjoyed that conversation with Sarah Jackson. I learned X, Y, and Z. All right. You can figure out how to do that. You're smart enough. All right, let's get back to our interview with Sarah Jackson. You know, I think about teams, people listening, and then, like, there might be on teams, and like, we haven't talked about things like necessarily technical debt on this particular conversation as of yet, but this is, it's not like, I feel like, do you feel like this is a, some of these things might identify some technical debt, or is it maybe some potentially necessary investments in hardening, or, you know, is there a way to like frame this in a way that, hey, we want to, like, I don't know if everybody might may or may not think this is glamorous work to do, is it like, let's work out all the weird edge cases that we hope never happen, but also kind of our job to reduce the risk as much as possible. Do you think there's a way to frame this in an effective way that helps stakeholders understand that this is a worthwhile thing to spend invested, and then you can use that a way as to sneak in some of that, I'm air quoting, tech debt that you've been also wanting to do, that kind of, because it's related?
Yes, 100%. The thing about these kinds of issues is that as much as they feel like edge cases, because they're not the happy path, they're things that happen every day. You know, AWS, one region or another will go down. Cloudflare will have issues. Heroku will have issues. Like, we see it pretty regularly in our industry, even to a small degree.
But in that scenario, it's their problem. It's not our fault. Right. So we can just wait around and for the rest of the day until it comes back on and be like, yeah, Cloudflare, how dare they? Like, they got to get figure out their shit, you know? So,
yeah, no, I hear you. I hear you. And I that is definitely a real argument that a lot of folks have. I know I have been in situations where something has gone down and I just spin around in my chair for the day. Not really. But it is true that as a developer, on a team, you can't actively intervene in that instance, in that incident. However, your customers are still facing a negative impact. And that is a negative impact on your brand and your user retention. So you want to make sure that when this bad thing happens, that's somebody else's fault, that you care about your customers and your brand enough that you are going to shore up against these exterior issues.
It also allows us to feel like we can do something as engineers. I think in those scenarios where it's another service and we're like, well, okay, we can't fix it at the moment. That's arguable. Maybe there actually is a workaround. Like, okay, whatever that endpoint is that's not available right now, maybe, well, what can we do in the moment to make a deployment? You know, if you can't deploy your app or whatever, that's a whole different issue altogether. But I think that there are probably steps that we could be taking that may or may not, like, well, let's just hope this never happens again. But like, hey, if S3 is down in our region, what do we do in that the next time that this happens? And I feel like if teams aren't thinking about that, just like, well, AWS is back up and we're back in business and those errors went away. And then what were we working on? This is the product backlog. And then do you feel like teams are prioritizing those things enough when that happens? Or is it just like, I think I know the answer to this question. They're just like, let's get back to the product backlog and we'll add that to the list of maybe one day we should probably address that too. And then, you know, it happens again at some point.
Honestly, I feel like a lot of teams don't even think about the idea of handling that scenario. A lot of developers, if AWS goes down, oh, that sucks, I can't do anything about it, is my sense. Maybe higher up leadership might consider something. But for the most part, if you're a developer, you're not working the customer service phones. I've been lucky enough to work on product teams where that was part of the role, to do training, to listen to customer service calls. When AWS goes down, your site is unavailable. Those calls go through the roof. That costs money. Those calls could be prevented by using chaos engineering ahead of time, being prepared for the worst case situation. So I feel like that is a really good selling point to leadership or management to bring this idea to their team, even if the team's like, oh, it's not, I didn't cause the error. What does it matter? Well, what matters is you have pride in your work. You have pride in your application. You have pride in the code that you've done. Don't you want it to work well? Don't you want customers to not think that there's a problem on their end and like throw their computer out the window?
Which happens. Like, I mean, I don't know if people are throwing the laptop out the window all that often, but they'll be like, is it me? Is it something else? And like, is it my network connection? And then is it this? It's so interesting that as developers sometimes get the vibe of on social media or whatever, when there is an outage, people are so quick, like, I need to move off of insert X to something else because this downtime that we've experienced over the last year has been too much. And so they'll be like, I'm looking for an alternative for this particular facet of the thing. And then like an alternative might be like, is that the only service that your app is dependent on? Or how are you going to respond when any, like, cause that's how your customers are thinking about you as well. They're just maybe not talking about it on social media in the same way with their peers. You know, we don't know where our customers are, where they're talking amongst themselves. You're like, yeah, we've had a bunch of issues with this platform, this SaaS product, but they might not be on social media complaining about it. They might be somewhere else doing that with other customers. And it's the same conversation, like, well, it's their problem, not mine. And I appreciate your take on this. It feels very proactive and think for building, say, resilient applications. And so I think some good food for thought for us and our audience there. I want to switch gears a little bit. And one of the other topics I was keen to talk with you about was your take on knowing that you have kind of a preference for keeping test suites wet, and not maybe dry. So what do you mean by that?
So dry, don't repeat yourself, parlance in the Ruby on Rails world. For folks that don't know, trying to consolidate code, make it reusable, make it modular, and so that can work in multiple places so that you're not writing the same thing. Tests should not be this way. This is a spicy opinion, but it's not a new opinion. And it's certainly one that's very strongly held by those of us at Thoughtbot. There, we've written a number of blog posts about this. I can send you the links to them so you can put them in the show notes. I have seen so many test suites that overuse the concept of let or shared examples or before statements, so much so that it becomes spaghetti code. You will have to hunt from file to file. Oh, this variable from a let is being modified in this shared example in another file, it becomes so inscrutable to actually read and understand what your test suite is doing, which is the antithesis of what a test suite should do. A test suite is almost like your living documentation. It will tell you how your application is supposed to work in the good, in the bad, in the ugly scenarios. If your tests are so hard to read that they lose that value, you know, what are we even doing here? I've also had to deal with trying to add or modify tests to situations like this. It becomes so cumbersome and it takes way more time than even just writing the feature itself. And it becomes an antagonist to the team. The team will not want to write or change tests as this goes on.
You know, and I'm thinking about how listeners might be kind of trying to wrap their head around what this might look like. So regardless of what tech stack you're working on, but let's say you have testing a bunch of things, let's say in a model or maybe a controller or something, and you have a bunch of setup type of things that all of the prerequisites so that any of this stuff could potentially run, right? And so where's that line of being like, well, when do we copy and paste this across lots of different sections of our test suite versus, and it kind of sounds like, but then you're also arguing, well, we end up modifying that anyhow. So, because I would imagine like if you add new prerequisites, then it might impact several files of tests at the same time. And you're like, well, now we added this new thing to the code and now 30 test files need to get updated. I could see how people would be thinking, well, wouldn't it be easier if it was just one shared thing and then we could change that one thing for that one time and it cascades to all those, you know, different files. Try to help me wrap my head around that a little bit.
Yes, I am definitely advocating for copy and pasting your setup for every single test because for the most part, each test is going to be a little different. You get to be explicit in each test what you're looking for. And you can utilize things like doubles or factories to, you know, kind of hand wave away the aspects of test object creation for things that aren't as important. But when you're doing a full robust test suite, you're testing so many different edge cases, so many different paths, so many differences of variables, that different combinations of variables. It is so much easier for a person who is reading the test, adding new tests, writing the test even, to see that everything that you need for the test is right there in the test. I know that it is doing these steps and this is what is expecting. I can see, reference the top, the where we're doing setup, that these are the variables, these are the values, these are the strings that are important to this test specifically. You don't have to worry about affecting other tests. It also prevents, you know, leaky tests because maybe you have a whole bunch of stuff that's defined in a let, but you have a test that's testing a path that would be like a short circuit sort of out and it doesn't need all of those things. And how is that going to affect that test? That's not reality. It wouldn't have those things in that scenario, but because you're doing a let and at the top of the file, it's changing the actual environment of the test, the subsequent examples. So it is very opposite of how we think about how we should be writing our code to be clean, to be dry, but thinking of tests as your living documentation, being self-contained, a self-contained snapshot of the world and the application that you are testing. Be wet AF. You know, don't worry about your file size. Files, you know, code files, it's text. It's kilobytes.
Interesting. And, you know, another, not that we need more incentives to, say, have more code, but to write more code. But it does, I would assume that the wetter your tests are, the better your code to test ratio is going to look. And that's not necessary. And it's not inaccurate. You know, I can get my head wrapped around this and I can see how there's a lot of value for thinking about it in this way. I'm always thinking about how teams will come in and like, later and be like, well, a lot of things get added to like setup types, you know, areas of for tests that you don't really know if it's all still needed because sometimes depending on how similar like documentation, how well do you maintain, like, because if do you always have to expect that, like the check that like, well, something got set up in our tests and we removed a piece of functionality. Did you remove all traces of that in your test or not? Or is it still like setting up for the potential of using something? And so now that's getting copy pasted around in a bunch of different areas and it's not even needed anymore. So I think trying to wrap your head around that, that's the job. That's our job as developers is to figure this stuff out and to keep things kind of as tidy as possible.
It makes it definitely a huge guessing game, and it makes code scary to change.
Do you have any little exercises or things that you would, for anyone looking at their test right now, if they were to pop up some like a test file right now and they wanted to experiment with identifying something that maybe is too dry or not, is there any kind of obvious things that you would suggest that they look for?
Shared examples and especially shared examples that redefine variables that exist in let statements.
You know, another thing preparing for this conversation, another slight pivot is, you know, you come into client engagements and quite often, and I would assume that there's a likelihood that you come into scenarios where a team is mid major refactor or something. And when an external team gets brought onto this, how do you start thinking about how to approach as a guest and to get up to speed, but then also to help the team kind of navigate if they don't have good test coverage already or good documentation? Like, how do you kind of help navigate that or influence like that early, that part of the process and where they are in the project, and like to help them get on track or to navigate that forward?
As a Thoughtbot consultant, when we come onto a team, we're not there necessarily to just write code. We're there to improve everything, to help adjust anything that might be a pain point. And obviously it's tailored to the team and the client, but part of that would be, okay, you are doing a refactor and your test suite doesn't have enough coverage yet. Before we continue with the refactor, we really need to get some base tests in, some base happy and sad paths tests in there so that we know that we're not causing any regressions with this refactor. Going back to the idea of testing being living documentation, how can you refactor if you're not 100% sure what your application's doing to begin with? And the testing gives us so much confidence in what we're doing, sort of like the TDD red-green refactor cycle of, if you do a refactor and you see that it's failing, then you know that you're not doing it right or something needs to change. But you need to have those tests there first. So my first thing that I would do if I joined a team like that, it would be to shore up the testing for sure.
Do you find yourself more often on team rewrite or team refactor?
Refactor. I have been on rewrites as well.
When do you think a rewrite is the right move?
A rewrite might only be valuable if there's no one else around that knows anything about the history or the code base, and it is so large that it's impenetrable. It is almost never the right move because it is so time intense. And I've seen it very commonly. Folks that do a rewrite will try to stay so true to the original that they end up rewriting the same issues, maybe not taking the time to dig deeper into implementation details and how do we do it differently. If you're looking at doing a rewrite, it's because there were issues and you don't want to replicate those. But at the same time, you know, we are living in the world of Stack Overflow and examples and tutorials and books that give us all of these great things that we can use in our code. It is almost part of our thought process to be like, oh, well, let's see how it was done before. But do you want to trust that? There's another type of process that I think is valuable that I would say is a port. Instead of a refactor or a rewrite, a port, going in with that knowledge that we are not making the same thing 100%. We want it to have the same functionality or similar functionality, but we are doing something completely different. But you have to have that mindset of that's what's happening so that you don't go look back at the code. Honestly, if you can lock the code away from the developers at that point, give them a black box.
Hey folks, it's Robbie here.
That would be ideal.
We get a lot of calls to start the same way. A small team is maintaining a Ruby on Rails app that's been around since, say, 2011. None of the original developers are still there, and over the years, folks have come and gone. And while the product keeps moving forward, the framework hasn't been upgraded in a long time. Everyone agrees it should happen, but when new hires join, they're focused on shipping features, fixing bugs, and keeping the lights on. Someone might carve out time to give it a try, maybe create a branch, start the upgrade, hit a few roadblocks, but then they get pulled back into something more, I'm air quoting, urgent. Momentum disappears, weeks pass, then months, then a year, and now it feels risky. And that's when Planet Argon gets the call. We don't show up to take over, we show up to guide. We create an upgrade roadmap, we embed with your team if needed. One developer, maybe a few, but the real goal? To help your team build the skill, to make upgrades feel possible again. Because the longer you wait, the harder it gets to start. PlanetArgon.com. Again, that's PlanetArgon.com. All right, let's get back to the show. That's interesting. I think, you know, I'm thinking with like scenarios where we've come into where teams are kind of hemming and hawing over like, well, they've convinced themselves that a rewrite is the only way to get away from their current reality or pain point that they're wherever they've gotten themselves to. And then I'm like, well, what are you going to do differently? And is it the same team, same practices, same? Is it like just because you didn't write tests or you had an architecture idea that maybe was a little over clever and you wish it would have been simpler and you're going to approach it differently now? Or do you have a whole new clever idea that you want to experiment with now? And like, is it a tech stack switch that you feel like is necessary? There's a lot of things, or it's just like, I just, it could be that the developer just disagree with what they decided 10 years ago. And they're like, we got ourselves into a mess, and or the business has pivoted so many times that we've just, it's all duct taped together and we need to revisit this. So like to, but then there's that tension of like, are we then taking all of the existing data, user data, customer, whatever all the information that this thing has been managing into this new future thing? And so it's kind of hard for them to wrap their head around like, well, how could we port it in a different way and like maybe reimagine what expected data is going to look like over here if it's not like a one-for-one database table, you know, just at a very granular level. Like, we got a database table of this type of data. We need to have a different system. Coming at it from like a, like, let's not look at the past because we're going to have to potentially migrate this data to some new format. Maybe that's an assumption that we're all making. Or maybe you don't actually, maybe you've collected too much data. You don't actually need all that anymore. The business, there's a whole new product. I think it seems like a challenging thing to do. But I agree that when teams are kind of navigating that and being like, well, we're just going to redo it, it would be interesting, like, just show me your plan and how it's going to be, what's different about it? Or is it just, and usually those teams, they're like, well, let me get to work. I'm going to start building out and come up with a thing. And they just want to start doing the thing. And they don't ever seem to have a big plan for it. But also, I don't know that they had experience with building out a lot of plans early on either, which might have gotten to them the same problem. So I don't know if you've seen that kind of example coming into those situations where how do you advise teams that are seemingly making maybe similar, I'm not saying mistakes, but they're exhibiting probably the same sort of things that they're not really fixing some more lower level kind of issues with their how they're thinking about these types of problems.
I'm actually on a client right now where we are porting something, but not everyone is necessarily thinking deeply about it like that. So one of the things that the team likes to ensure is to sign offs on code review and like really analyzing models before they go in. I think we have had so many discussions about the models of the data, and initially we kind of got, when we were looking at the database table from before, from a completely different database, former code base that we were porting over, we would ask, oh, do we want to bring all of these columns over? The answer was yes. But digging into them more, it lifted out so many deeper sort of philosophical questions of, do we want to continue doing that in this world? For example, there was an is deleted column. We got to raise the question, what was this for? Is soft deletion something that was part of your flow? Is it something that your customers expected? Is it something we want to keep doing? And we decided, no, it wasn't something that we wanted to do anymore. It was something that was just kind of easy in the ecosystem, in the code base that they were using before. And if we hadn't had that discussion, that like being real with ourselves of like not just one-to-one copying over, we could have been going down a bad path again. So yeah, planning beforehand, so valuable. Really need to get the team into that mindset. Really need to be picking over the nitty-gritty details from the beginning.
I find that it's interesting to try to like to go in and have to, I would imagine for teams, it's exhausting having to go through at a granular level and decide, do we still need this or not? Like that question, it's like, well, it might just seem easier, but like assume we're going to keep almost everything. And then on like the product level, it's like, we want to have high level of or pretty decent level of feature parity, but it's also like under the hood data parity. And it's like, well, do we actually need to carry all of this over? What can we get rid of? And that's where I always end up starting to like when we're coming to consulting engagements, when we can have those types of conversations, when they're thinking about the new potential thing one day, I'm like, well, can you not remove that now in your existing system? If you spend some time removing some of that from your current application because you don't really see a need for it in the future version of yourself, can you reduce the complexity of your current situation so that you can make different choices in the future and you can continue building off of this and not just be like, well, we've got ourselves into a corner. We can't get rid of it, but we're going to build a whole new thing and not take... Like, wait a minute. I feel like if you're not willing to do that, I'm like, help me see how that's actually... more difficult. That actually seems like I would like to just to, you know, think about if anyone listening out there, like, what can you delete from your system? Go find it, remove it, like fight for something that stuff. Cause like it'll unblock you. Stuff that you're using right now might not actually even be needed to be. You don't need to have every one of those features or pieces of functionality in there. Probably. I say that, and it's easy for me to say that from my microphone here, but I do think that seems like an easier problem for teams to solve than let's have a successful rewrite on the surface.
I agree. The more code, unused code you can delete, the better. At Thoughtbot, we have a Slack channel called Dead Code where we can show our plus minus sort of like snapshot from a PR.
Everybody should have a Dead Code channel. All right. I've kept you long enough. I have a couple of quick last questions for you. I think you've given a lot of good advice. I'm not going to ask you for that. But I'm curious, is there a non-technical book, non-software book that you find yourself recommending to peers?
Absolutely. I read this book earlier this year and it is amazing. I can't stop talking about it. It's called Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error by Catherine Schulz. Don't know if I'm pronouncing her last name right. But it encompasses the idea of being wrong and everything that means, you know, our eyes playing games on us misremembering, believing an incorrect fact, us having different beliefs, how we feel viscerally about being wrong or right, and how that impacts the world. It is an amazing read. Everyone needs to read it. It all boils down to empathy.
I'll definitely include links for that for everybody in the show notes for that as well. And then where can listeners best follow your thoughts and ruminations about software engineering online?
Oh, I don't do a whole lot online other than shitposting my software thoughts. But you can find me at vmst.io/@csarah, no H on the Sarah.
Links will be in the show notes for everybody. And with that, it's been such a delight having you join us on Maintainable, Sarah. Thank you so much for stopping by to talk shop with us.
Absolutely. Thank you. I had a lot of fun.
You've been listening to Maintainable, a Planet Argon production. Editing by Claudia Armbruster. Post-production by Autumn Morgan and Ella Svensson. Emotional support from the letter M. For Maintainable, for momentum, for making things better. If this episode resonated with you, share it with someone who needs to hear it. Keep showing up. See you next time. Maintainable.